Just a friendly reminder that the opinions expressed on this show are not worth a Canadian penny, so disregard anything you hear that might get anyone in trouble. And despite some of the great ideas you may hear, don't try them at home. Go to a friend's house instead.
It's time to get a gun. That's what I've been thinking. Well, I could afford one. And if I did just a little less drinking, time to put something between me and the sun. Time to get a gun.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 99.5 of Slamfire Radio. That's right, 99.5. We've had some scheduling issues, and we needed another week of buffer before we got to episode 100. But we didn't want to leave you hanging, so we thought, well, let's record an episode 99.5. Who can we get on that's half as good as the rest of us?
That's one version of the story. Another version could be that we absolutely refused to let Brian on episode 100. So since he was scheduled to come on this week, we simply changed the name from 100 to 99.5.
That works too. I mean, that's another good explanation. Brian, do you have an explanation as to why you're here?
Yeah, Brian, what are you doing
here?
Yes,
I actually have the explanation.
Okay.
We thought that one of the three of you couldn't make it, and it seemed wrong to do episode 100 with a stand-in instead of the three of you, so I suggested do 99.5.
I just
find that hard to believe, Matthew. Don't you think that's suspicious that he would be the noble one?
I think so, yeah. It's
sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
And with that, thanks for listening. No, wait, no, we're just starting.
Yeah, right. We haven't even given our names yet. Yeah. I don't even know if you gave your name yet.
I didn't, no. I'm Matthew.
I'm Trevor.
I'm Owen.
I'm Brian.
And that's right, we're all here, and then some. So, yeah. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, I think.
Yeah, you'll find out at the end if it was fun or not.
Yeah, I'm not. So far, we'll see.
Yeah, like Dietmar Trillis once said to me when I said, "It's nice to meet you," you say that now.
Wait a while.
That's for Ed. Ed'll get that.
Perfect. Because we here on Slamfire Radio love to tell jokes that pertain to just one person.
Pretty much, the rest
of the listeners, it's okay. You guys don't need to get it. As long as Ed gets it, we're cool.
Yep. Yeah, he will. Oh, he had some good feedback for us on last week's gun clearing episode. He's like, our house clearing episode. He's like, yeah, me and my buddies, we used to do that too. We were seven. We called it playing guns.
Yeah. And it is. And well, we're just not seven and it's still fun. And we still call it playing guns.
Yeah.
Good a reason as any.
Yeah.
All right. Well, why don't we kick off what we did with guns this week? Owen, why don't you start us off there?
Sure. Yeah. I did nothing.
There we go.
That was easy.
It's been a short week. Come on.
It's true. It is actually Tuesday. We know you're listening to this on Friday at the regular scheduled time, but we are actually listening to or recording this on Tuesday. So really, we haven't had much of a chance to do really anything.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't
done a thing. I'm actually currently traveling. I'm actually in Halifax right now. So probably not going to get anything done this week.
Good enough.
Well, in Halifax, you could be involved in an armed robbery or shooting or holdup.
You could be.
That's
true. I mean, it is
so
a fairly dangerous city.
Yeah, there's still some potential for some gunplay before the week is done, buddy. Hang in there.
Yeah, keep your head up.
As soon as the show's over, I'll go out and I'll find the bad part of town and I'll wander around in the dark and we'll see what happens.
Godgeson Street. Go there.
Alrighty then. And on that note, goodbye, Owen.
Don't go there.
Brian, let's move on to you then.
I haven't done much. I've done some dry fire practice. Kind of getting ready to go to Michigan this weekend to shoot an apple seed. That's about it that really involved a gun.
Oh,
I spent way too long at a club. Well, it's something. Yeah, I did get to play with my CERT laser bolt and my AR-15.
Those
and,
are cool.
Yeah, I like it. And I've got the Rangemaster camera system, so it'll actually record through a webcam where my laser hits are on a target, so I can look back and
Yeah. That's cool.
It is cool. If the software really well, it would be really cool, but it works sort of so-so.
So it is
what it is.
How is this different, Brian, from the one that Foley had at your time when we were all hanging out by the pool?
Foley's didn't have a camera. Foley had a target that you hit, and it would show where the hit was.
Oh, on the target. Right. Okay.
Yes.
This works with the camera.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure if he doesn't, you know what? He does have the Rangemaster system too.
Of course he does.
Yeah. Cause of course, cause he's got a webcam hard mounted to his ceiling in his basement and it's all run
and his
through.
Bedroom.
And we won't ask why. Let's keep going.
Yeah, let's leave that one alone. But yeah, no, he's got it all set up with, you know, he's routing it through a server. I think that the NSA is checking his scores and stuff as he's practicing it. Like it's all pretty high tech for him. He's into that stuff. So
he's a very high tech kind of guy.
He is. Yeah. You wouldn't know what to talk to him, but he is actually pretty high tech. So,
yep.
Let's see. Then I recorded with Trevor last night. We talked enough. Wednesday on episode 51 of Modern Rifleman Radio. So if the listeners want to listen to that, they should go check out that episode.
Cool.
Filthy referred to it as gold.
Oh, good. Oh,
well, there you go. I mean, if it gets the Clone Trooper stamp of approval, we might as well all go listen to it.
Hey, you know.
I mean, Clone Troopers, they could definitely benefit with some advice on the mental aspect of shooting. I'm just saying.
Well, but don't they all think alike because they're clones?
Yeah,
so and they basically have train one, train them all. I don't know.
Yeah, and they have a boss who's pretty hard on them.
Yeah,
like their boss really doesn't care much about them. There's not much for you know labor laws and stuff in the Empire. Now it's interesting that Filthy said that to you because he didn't say anything like that to me today. So you know, Phil, maybe you could share a little bit of the love this way. You know, just saying, you could try.
He's probably
I'm just
not
saying.
Going to.
It could be because my back is sore because I carried you the whole episode, but I'm not sure.
well, no, because you were a guest on my show,
and unlike this show,
I didn't want
to
just keep
talk. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to just keep interjecting for the sake of interjecting, just to be funny, you know. So I thought I added things where it was appropriate, but other, you know, I don't know. I'm new at this podcast thing, so maybe I'm doing it wrong. We'll see.
Maybe.
Huh.
Still there, Matt?
No, I've left.
Yeah, I think we got him with all the wheels on that bus.
I think you backed it up, too.
It's funny because it started off as a dig at Brian, but man, did you turn that around quickly? I mean, that escalated really
fast. Well, yeah. Anyway, then after that, we got finished early, and I made the mistake of going to my club general meeting. Oh, my, that ran long. Ooh, goodness gracious.
Yeah, bud.
Oh, man. Anyway, there's no progress like no progress, and that's where my club wants to be. So that's fine. It is what it is. And then let's see. The last thing, I'm getting ready to go to Michigan this weekend for an apple seed, so I've got stuff held in various corners of the house ready to go in the car, and I have to actually check everything off my list to make sure I bring everything that I actually need. So should be fun.
Very good.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you at least had a partially fun week so far, and your week's going to get awesome once you head over to Michigan and do that apple seed.
It has potential to be awesome, yes.
Yeah,
I will at least do some shooting.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing all about that because I want to get to an apple seed as soon as I can. So sometime this spring or summer, I'm going to see about getting to the one in Maine. So that'll be cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it's probably not that far away from you, right? The range are having it at
4 hours, I think. So it's not too bad.
Yeah,
so
that's not bad.
Pop down there, and I'll pick your brain before I go, see what to expect and whatnot. So, it's good that you guys are doing this because it gives me a bit of a heads up.
Yeah, hey, that's part of the fun.
Matthew, have you looked into the schedule for the state of Maine to see if there are any handy to where you're at?
Yes, there is one. I forget the date, but there is one in Maine this summer, and I'm going to see if Gallen wants to go with me, actually, because he and I were talking about that a while ago, about heading to an apple seed. So he said if I found one, and he had the same time off as I did, we should go together. So maybe he'll be my shooting buddy and traveling buddy. You can come too if you want, Trevor, I guess. Whatever.
Yeah, no, I'd really be interested.
That's a really warm invitation.
Yeah, well, I mean, after he's driving the bus the way he is, whatever.
Or not come. That's fine, too.
I mean, if you don't want to, you don't have to. Don't feel obligated.
Or stay the hell home.
I mean, that's always an option too. It's hilarious.
I can feel the love on this episode. Lots of love.
It's funny. Generally, we get along fine until you show up.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was just thinking. Yeah, I'm apparently the
You're like that bratty little cousin that only visits in the summertime, stirs everybody up, and then leaves.
Yeah.
And every time somebody touches him, he runs to your aunt. Yeah, that's you.
I was with you up until the last comment. Yeah, I'm fine with being the disturber who just shows up once in a while, but yeah, no.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that first edit point, Brian. And we'll move on to what I did with guns this week. So I went and did some pop can hunting, which was a lot of fun. Pop cans are in season this time of year.
Speaking of which, Matthew, your video with the can of Dr. Pepper behind the snowbank.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yep.
Awesome.
So, yes, I was talking about my Bushnell AR-22 scope last week. And Filthy, our beloved clone trooper, asked for a bit of a review on it. He said maybe post some pictures or do a video up. And so, of course, Filthy asks, I deliver. So I put together a video review of that scope for him and put it up on YouTube. And yes, there's some pop can hunting in it because why not? I mean, if I'm going to go out in the woods and shoot something, I might as well actually shoot something I can actually see because I put it there myself. So anyway, don't have to worry about finding the rabbits if I plant the rabbit. So that was fun. I went to the range and did a bit more shooting with the Marlin and the Savage. I said last week that I swapped the scopes on them, and I did. And the Savage is shooting the Blazer at typical group still of around 3/4 of an inch at 50 yards, which is about what I'm expecting. And the Marlin, wearing the 2-7 now, is a lot of fun to shoot out at multiple distances. And I think I showed that in the video as well, shooting through the scope at different targets at different distances and using the subtensions on the reticle there to get my hits without having to adjust the turrets or anything. So that was a lot of fun. It was a cool day at the range. I got a really, really good 4-shot sub 1/2-inch group with CCI Blazer through the Savage. I mean, every bullet, it was like a clover leaf. And then the 5th shot opened it up to about 3/4 of an inch. Me or the rifle or the ammo or whatever, I don't know. It was kind of disappointing that last shot, but to get 4 of them into less than 1/2 inch at 50 yards was just, it was staggering. I couldn't believe that it happened, and it was awesome. So I was really excited about getting some good groups out of that rifle finally, and hopefully the good groups continue on.
Especially so, with that ammo, Matthew, as opposed to having to track down the CCI standard velocity and pay more for it. And
yep.
Like, I've got some Blazer here. You can just have it.
Beauty.
You know,
it doesn't work in anything that you got, huh?
Well, I bought it as a test for when I had my Mark II.
Right.
And it's just been kind of sitting around ever since. And then I think I put it through a pistol once, and I just, my other guns prefer the 5.55 bulk pack.
Yep.
So I don't have a lot. Like, I got a couple of hundred or whatever, but whatever mm-hmm. I have is yours, man.
Beauty. Cool. Thanks. But that's it. That's all I've done with guns so far this week. So, Trevor, what did you do?
I got some shoesting done. I made it nice. To the rest. Yeah, I actually went out with McIntyre, Jason McIntyre, our new Muffin. It's the new club president of, actually, he got a call today. Squirrel. He got a call today from Radio Canada, the French version of CBC radio, wanting to get an interview done or just a quote for their afternoon news broadcast with regards to Stephen Harper saying that rural Canadians need access to firearms for self-defense. That's right. Our prime minister said that. Like, actually, to shoot people. You need access to guns when you live in the country so that you can shoot bad people.
Well, how else are you supposed to shoot people if you don't have a gun?
Exactly. So God love Premier or Prime Minister Harper for saying that publicly, and the Liberals are losing their minds. So anyway, McIntyre called me, and he didn't want to do the interview because, A, he's like completely not political. It doesn't follow that stuff. And, well, that's it. There is no B. So, and I was too hesitant to do it because that would exceed the limits of my French vocabulary, and I would start to sputter and stuff. And so I wasn't comfortable doing it. So, unfortunately, it didn't get done. It's too bad because I would have loved to. They asked him, like, you know, so do you think you should have a gun for self-defense? He's like, yeah. Like, well, what are you asking the club president that kind of question for?
it was kind of the way he phrased it, too. He's like, when you live out in the country and the police are a long ways away, you need some sort of access to firearms to defend yourself. I mean, and that's just common sense. It's just really nice to hear him actually say that in public. But you're right. I mean, I've been following some of these news stories, and you go into the comment section, and even some of the news stories themselves from some of the media that's definitely has a left slant to their programming, and they're just I can't believe the level of
Oh, well, the National Post is pretty much saying Harper says we should murder each other.
Yeah. Like, I can't believe that they can put words into his mouth like that. But, of course, that's what they do because they're doing everything they can to make him look bad so that they get our overlords back in power.
Yeah, because they're the liberal media. Yeah. It's their job.
And it's just – yeah. But, the people in the comments are just absolutely losing their minds. And it's nice to see every now and then you can see somebody who's a, you know, a true Canadian gun owner who understands the finer points of this, and they're actually interjecting some actual reality, some actual logic, some actual facts. I don't see anybody's mind being swayed, but at least it's nice to see that in there and people are, being exposed to it a little bit.
I went on and I gave the usual analogies of, you know, I have a fire extinguisher. I don't think I'm a fireman. I learned first aid because I don't travel with an EMT, and I want access to firearms because I don't have a police officer living here with me.
Right.
But what I should have pointed out was, hey, kids, we already have the right to defend ourselves, and we have the right to defend ourselves with firearms. This is not news, but it's so great though. It's not news to you and I and the other two guys with us tonight, like we're preaching to the choir, but it's still wonderful for us to have the leader of Canada come out and say publicly, Canadians need to have access to guns to shoot bad people when bad people need to be shot.
That's it. And you know what? I've said it before. I'll say it again. Sometimes there are people who just need to be shot.
Well, you need to stop threats.
That's it. And that's what I mean by that. It's just funnier when I say it my way.
Of course. Sometimes the best tool to stop a threat is a firearm.
That's it.
You know? So, anyhow.
I also think Owen
goes first here.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I also think it's interesting that I think we all would agree that that right shouldn't just apply to rural people. It should apply to everybody, rural,
somebody
non-rural,
raised that point,
you know,
yeah.
But you got to start somewhere. And
yeah, that's right.
If it's small steps, right? And you start with the people that you can make an argument for and you go from there.
I guess the logic, Owen, is that in the country, police are, you know, a really long ways away sometimes. But in the city, yep. Somebody raised the same point you did. Well, what about the city? We stand a better chance of having being a victim of a home invasion than people in the country do. And that's an excellent point. But apparently, and we all know this is a crock, apparently police respond faster in the city. But they're still responding after the fact.
That's the thing. They can't be there in time ever. Brian, you were going to say something.
They can only respond to a call. And if you don't have time to make a call because somebody's breaking into your house, excuse me, home invader, could you please stop for a minute? I have to make a call.
Yeah, hold on a second while
I
call the
and
police.
Bludgeon me. No, yeah. It just doesn't
exactly.
work.
Exactly. So anyway, I'll go ahead, Brian.
I think something I saw in those comments, because I was looking at some of the threads Trevor was commenting on Facebook. There was comments like, well, you can't just blow people away back into your house. That's true. But if I have a firearm in my possession, it stands just the fact that I have a firearm stands as a big deterrent to somebody who decides whether or not they're going to continue with breaking into my home and or attacking me and my family.
Yeah, that's right.
Before the mere presence of the firearm is going to do quite a bit.
Before they come up the stairs, I will announce what's waiting for them at the top of the stairs.
Hot lead, come and get it.
Yeah.
Sort of, kind of.
So that was all because I went to the range with Jason. So at the range, I had the VZ58 out again because I put a new Burris quick detach 30mm red dot optic mount on the rifle, and I needed to sight it in again. And while I had it out, I took all the same mags, Matthew, that I had out when I was with you, unfortunately, except for the one with the damaged feed lip.
Right.
I didn't put ammo in that, put that back in my ammo cabinet because I didn't want to leave it in there with ammo in it in case ever I needed it and until I tested it again. So since I put it aside, naturally it didn't come back to the range.
Of course.
So I tested all the other mags and I decided to try and make the gun fail. I tried to induce a failure to feed or whatnot by really putting some unnecessary pressure onto the magazine with the Magwell adapter. This is the Gen 2, I guess you could call it, Magwell adapter. The first AR Magwell adapters for this platform, I believe, were made by a third-party company. So this Magwell adapter is made by CSA, the same manufacturer that makes the gun. And people have been saying that's a lot more reliable than the first generation. And so I wanted to kind of test it a little bit. So when I had the gun at the range, I monopotted it on the on the mag and push really hard on the front and back of the receiver to try and get it to, I was trying to induce a failure to feed or some kind of failure. And I just put all kinds of torque on the magazine and the magwell adapter every which way I could. No problems whatsoever. Got it sighted in at 50, and it shoots a 5-inch group with a red dot inside a half an inch at 50. I can't...
That's good. That's really good. That's
really good. Yep. I mean, it's benched and everything and being very careful and taking
my
time.
But that's the point of finding the accuracy limit of your rifle. You want to do it like that.
Yep, you got it. So
that's fantastic.
And this was a variety of ammo, everything from some American Eagle to some Nork to some of my hand loads. So
very nice.
Yeah, and then I shot the SR9, and I shot it for accuracy. I shot unfortunately, the way the target stand was set up and with the limitations of the range this time of year, it was only 5 yards, but it was close. But I still... I guess anybody who can shoot a pistol correctly can dump 10 bullets in the same hole at 5 yards, or they should be able to anyway.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. So I put about 150 rounds through it. It was great. You know, the sights, for metal over meat inside of 10 yards, the sights are fine. I did run into one problem, however, and that was if I took a really aggressive grip on the gun, my strong hand, the middle finger of my strong hand, ends up hitting the ambidextrous side of the magazine release under recoil, and I drop the mag.
And that's a feature, right? You can drop your mag when you don't want to.
Yep, it's not a desirable feature, but it is a feature of this gun in my hands. So, if you have to be really, really careful how you hold your pistol, if this was my only gun, I would take off that right side magazine release, so that would never happen again. But, you know, since this is just a gun to plink with at the range and let people try and stuff like that, I'm not going to modify it because this is not going in the bedside safe. This is not going in the IPSC belt. This is just a gun and it's part of my collection.
Right.
So, shot well, really like it. You know, it's a good gun. Like I said, I can't wait for you to get your hands on it to confirm whether or not the reset is shorter than yours was on the trigger.
Right.
Got no issues with this trigger. I really like it. So, and then I've spent some time this week with the Magpul Dynamics Art of the Shotgun and my 870, getting reacquainted, doing some shotgun drills, reloading drills, and admin reloads and combat reloads and all that fun stuff with my 870.
Nice. That's always fun to do.
It is. It is. Now, I've wanted to get my 590 barrel sent off to get threaded for chokes. And now I'm kind of looking at the VanComp system for both as well. But I don't know how much it would increase the noise. I'd have no problem hunting with these guns and in the woods and shooting them without hearing protection. Unless I put the VanComp system or have the VanComp system added to the...
You can do the backbore portion of the VanComp but not actually get the ports put in.
Okay.
And that will give you the, you get the pattern that will more closely resemble that of a modified, but you don't have the ports drilled into the hole, which means that you don't get the added noise.
Okay. So I want to do it to reduce recoil.
Right. And that's what the back boring does. It helps reduce the perceived recoil. I mean, all the recoil is still there, but it's just over a longer impulse. And okay. So you feel it. Instead of you feel it in 1 microsecond, you feel it in 2 microseconds. Those aren't actual numbers. I just made them up. But you know what I mean? So yeah. You get it just feels like it's less recoil, which is exactly what you want. I mean, you're never going to cheat physics. You're always going to have the same amount of recoil. Yeah. But to make it softer perceived still makes you a faster shooter.
Mm. Yeah, right on. So I'm looking at that, but it's not terribly expensive. It's like $255 or something to get the full VanComp system.
But putting in chokes is about 150.
No, I think he'll just thread a barrel for $90.
Oh well, there you go. So I think
Priceless is there anyway on his website. So yeah, and then on Sunday I got invited to do some tracking on a human blood trail. So that was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw your Facebook post on that, and I immediately called you, and I believe the first words out of my mouth were, "And you have a story to tell."
No, not really.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. You don't follow a human blood trail without a story.
That's correct.
Yeah, so a friend of mine had his sister's car stolen out of his driveway in the middle of the day, somewhere between 11 and 12:30. They stole his sister's brand new Ford Focus, drove it over to the high school, and trashed it. And in the process of trashing it, they cut themselves, and they left a fair amount of blood on the snow. So he came over and asked me if I was willing to help him track the blood. So I was like, I'm your Huckleberry. Let's go. So Christina's like, where are you going? Nowhere. She said, play nice. So he didn't come get me because I play nice. He came to find me for a reason. So as we're tracking, he's like, we should have McClatchy with us. I'm like, McClatchy's never shot anything that leaves blood trails. What are you talking about? It was that one time he took the head off of the rabbit and he got blood on his face.
And I found the rabbit.
Right, because it was at your feet.
Well, I still found it. Some just of it, because yeah. The blood trail started on my face and ended at my feet doesn't mean anything.
Exactly. So the blood trail conveniently went past not one but two video cameras at the back door of the high school. And followed the blood trail until the snow was done and we got into the parking lot and headed in a general direction of a certain type of a certain socioeconomic level of housing complex, if you will. And we couldn't follow it anymore. Then we kind of went through the neighborhood looking at doors to see if somebody had left a bloody handprint on a door or doorknob or something. But at that point, we were done. So anyway, it turns out that a friend of the show, you know who, was on the case, and they arrested two guys yesterday, maybe.
Nice.
So, or maybe even Saturday or Sunday night.
Well, that's good. I'm glad they got them.
Yeah, they went straight to the video cameras and, oh, these guys, again, super. You know, it was probably one of those things. Oh, look, it's frickin' Frack, yeah. So anyway.
Yeah, when they know them by name, it's kind of like, okay, yeah. You're troublemakers.
Because I was thinking anybody that bled that much had to go to the emergency room. And this isn't Toronto. Chances are the only person that day that got stitches was the suspect. No need. They went to the cameras, I guess, and so... This is all, you know, hearsay and whatnot.
Of course.
Yeah. And the show is for entertainment purposes only.
Entertainment only, yep.
So, and what else? I was on with Brian. Brian and I did our second installment of mental management for the shooting sports, and it was a heck of a lot of fun.
That's good.
Yeah, that's all.
Is your back feeling better from carrying me through the show there, Trevor?
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad.
Okay.
Right. You know.
Because, you know, I know you're delicate that way.
Hey, man, I'm the guy who, Matthew, today, somebody was complaining about that incline. Somebody was complaining about the incline at the range.
Right.
That you walk up to get to the covered firing point. You know the one, Matthew?
I know the one.
Look. Yeah. I mean, I was injured walking up that slight incline. Anyway, so this old, he's pretty, well, old guy. He's older than me. And so anybody older than me is old. So he's like, you know, that hill going up, but he says, it's not easy going up that hill with a bunch of rifles and stuff when you're my age. I'm like, your age? I blew a calf muscle walking up that thing. And we sounded like two old guys in a barbershop. Well, we were in a barbershop and we are two old guys, but we were those guys, you know, back in my day.
And, oh, hilarious.
Yeah, my life's a joke.
Sure. All right, well, let's move on to some upcoming events then. And we want to mention, of course, the 5th annual charity shoot, which is June 27th. All the proceeds are going toward the Dalhousie Nursing Home Foundation. So come one, come all. It's going to be a lot of fun. You can contact us and we'll give you directions and tell you how to get there. And we'll even get an invite letter put out here very shortly. So you'll be able to bring your restrictions if you so choose. There's going to be 22 silhouette shooting. There'll be some shotgun shooting, shooting some trap. We'll be doing a mini sort of IPSC match in the afternoon. It's going to be a lot of fun. So come on out, have some fun with us, raise some money for a good cause. The para course with Tommy is scheduled for July 3rd. There's going to be, it's full, but of course the next day on July 4th, the IDPA mini match. You might want to come out and try shooting some IDPA. It's a little bit different from IPSC, and by a little bit, I mean a lot. So if you want to come get disqualified right away, or actually, no, you probably just come out
lots
and get a
of
lot
procedurals.
Of procedural. So if you want to learn what it's like to lose because you're fast, come on out and shoot some IDPA. SummerSlam registrations are open for that. That's the level 3 match that Trevor's putting on this year at the Restigouche Gun Club. And I say Trevor's putting it on because he's the director of it or something. Yeah, I don't know. He's doing like a lot of work. I don't know.
Yeah, the registrations are rolling in. They're starting to flood in. We got about 86 spots left.
That's fantastic. So you want to shoot SummerSlam, get your name in soon, or you're not going to be able to come.
Trevor, are your favorite Ipswich shooters from Ontario coming to that again this year?
Yeah, and some of my not favorite ones, too.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just kidding. Who are my favorite Ipswich shooters? Like Pat and Chris?
No, I mean the ones that were not your favorites is the, actually
oh,
what I was
he,
talking
he,
about.
He who shall not be named?
Voldemort's coming? Oh, hilarious.
We're nerds.
A little bit. So yeah, SummerSlam. Come on out and get Avacadabra'd. I'm kidding.
Actually, truth is, we're running about 50-50 on the Ontario and Quebec registrations, and I've got three from New Brunswick, so, yeah.
Cool. All right. The last two things I want to mention, the NFA Annual General Meeting is being held in Quebec City, May 23rd and 24th. If you're a member of the NFA, you should be considering going to that if you're anywhere near the vicinity of Quebec City. So go out, show your support, and find out what's going on there. Also, the CSSA Annual General Meeting is starting at 10 a.m. on May 30th, so that's just a few days later, at the Ottawa Conference and Events Center. Oddly enough, in Ottawa. So if you're close by to Ottawa and you are a CSSA member, of which you should be, of course, go out and, again, support that organization as well. Both of the organizations need our support, and so you should, if you live close by, you should be out there attending those meetings because things get discussed and things get decided on, and the people who show up help get to run it. So get out there and get your input put in.
I wonder if they're looking for field officers.
They very well could be.
You got some room in your schedule, Trevor?
Maybe.
All right. Well, we're going to actually skip the NFA discussion this evening. We're going to move directly into our main topic. We may have some more information on that next week, so do stay tuned next week for some more information on that. But this week, we are going to just kind of give that a bye, and we're going to move on to talking a bit about scopes. All of us shoot rifles with scopes. Most people who are into guns use scopes on their guns, but not everybody has taken the time to actually look into how to properly do anything with a scope. There are proper ways of mounting it, proper ways of deciding which one you want to use, proper rings that you should be using, proper bases, and then we're going to go through some of the features, what the features mean. We're going to talk about weird abstract ideas like parallax. So I did my air quotes there because a lot of people are like, what's parallax? So we're going to talk about that, and we're gonna have a good time about it, hopefully. And hopefully it's actually going to be informative as opposed to just entertaining. But that's up to Brian because he's the expert.
Well, yeah. That's why we have Brian on, so that it'll be informative this week.
That's right. And entertaining as we make fun of him.
Wait a minute. Okay, that I can believe, that last part. Yeah, I'm not so sure about the informative. And you used the E word. I don't like that E word.
Entertainment?
No,
expert. Expert. Well, we'll see, won't we?
Yeah.
Yes. Reserve judgment.
That's right. Well, why don't we start off by talking about the different scope rails that are available? So we'll be talking about the gun itself in some cases. Some guns actually come with scope rails integrated into them. And, of course, the most common one is the 22 long rifle tip-off rails. So a lot of 22s come with them, although I am finding recently, as more and more manufacturers come up with new designs, they're not including the tip-offs because more and more people are going towards the Weaver and the Picatinny rails. So the tip-off rails are sort of becoming a bygone era, but they are still out there. They do come in two measurements, so it is important when you're buying your rings to determine which size you have. There's a 3/8 or an 11 millimeter. So make sure you do check that. There's really not much to talk about with these, except...
Well, I do have one thing. Yep. By tip-off, do you mean, like, dovetail?
Well, see, a lot of people call them dovetail.
Yes, and see, I've never called them tip-off because I think of tip-off as a specific type of scope base.
Oh, okay. Interesting, yeah. Because I've heard people call them dovetails, but then I had somebody tell me, and of course, this person wasn't an expert, so they may have been wrong, and maybe I'm now wrong in thinking this, but that dovetail was actually the incorrect term for it, and that tip-off was the correct term for it. But
I don't know. Either or.
So now, hopefully now everybody knows what we're talking about, the dovetail / tip-off.
Yes. Yeah, and for those who don't know, on many rimfire rifles, there's just two grooves that have been machined into the top of the action that run parallel with the action, and you can just, you have a scope ring that will just clamp into there, kind of like a claw on a really vicious animal, except it's not an animal, it's a scope base.
Oh, yeah. Okay, now I get you. I wasn't really sure what you guys were talking about at all. So, yeah. I've had 22 receivers that have those, well, yeah, for lack of a better term, dovetails, but they're not really dovetails.
Right.
No, they're not really dovetails. So maybe that's not the right term either.
It does kind of look like an upside down dovetail. The part that kind of sticks up above the receiver, if you flipped it upside down, it would kind of look like a dovetail as you'd see on a dovetail, like a rear sight or something like that.
Right.
Now, when I picture dovetail, I think about a male and a female, you know, what? One part slides into another one, a negative and a positive, but this is just kind of...
Yeah, I know what you're saying there, Trevor, too.
Yeah, a rail machined in
the top. Let's go back to where Owen said I was right, and let's move on from there.
All right.
The one thing I do want to mention about the dovetails or tip-offs or the 22-style rails is that with the more popular, and people will probably know what I mean by the Picatinny or Weaver rails, they have cross slots cut into them. And a bolt will actually fall into that cross slot and prevent the scope from moving fore and aft. The dovetail style does not have that. And so some guns who have this, they're known if sometimes the recoil impulse is just so, sometimes your scope rings will actually move under fire. And even on a 22, I've had this happen. And so the trick is to not over tighten it, because you'll just squeeze the crap out of your receiver, and sometimes you'll actually dent it, especially if it's like a cast aluminum receiver. The trick is you can actually buy rings that have a screw drilled down through the base itself that puts in it's called like a recoil stop or a stop pin, and it screws right down onto the receiver and actually makes contact and adds more friction so that the scope won't travel under recoil. So that's something to watch out for if you do have that style of scope rail. But
yeah. And you're probably only going to see that type of scope rail on a 22 or an air rifle.
That's correct. Anybody who has a Marlin 795, you'll know exactly what we're talking about, because those rifles do have this style of scope rail. So, but I think that's enough about that, because it is, like I said, sort of falling out of favor, and more mm-hmm. people are moving into the Weaver or Picatinny rails. So, Brian, you have a lot of experience with those. Why don't you tell us what those are?
Okay, so basically, if you look at a Weaver or Picatinny rail, you're going to see kind of like a ladder pattern, these horizontal cross slots that you can, like Matthew said, you mount a base or a ring to that. There's a cross bolt in that base that fits in one of those slots. So once everything's tightened down, it can't move backwards. Now with Weaver, there's some variation, as I understand, between the size and the spacing with the cross slots, whereas the Picatinny has been standardized. Generally speaking, actually, I shouldn't say that. There is a level of interchangeability. I think I forget which is which. I think if you have Picatinny, you can always use Weaver, but if you have Weaver, you can sometimes use Picatinny. I'm not 100% on that. Somebody more knowledgeable than me
cleared that up there last week or the week
before. Okay, maybe that's where I heard it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can't remember which way it goes now.
There you go. So go back to Weaver, episode 99 yeah. and re-listen to Matthew.
It's 98, actually. 98.
Sorry, 98, yeah. Yes. No, it was...
Because this is 99 and a half, which is really 100. But don't tell anybody. We're not celebrating
yet.
So the
last episode was 99.
Right, but it was two episodes ago that I talked about it.
It was get all your rails and Picatinny,
and get your accessories in Weaver. A Weaver will always fit on a Picatinny, but a Picatinny accessory won't always fit on a Weaver. And but that again, that only really applies to older Weaver rails. Weaver has sort of stepped into the 21st century with Picatinny being introduced, and they have now any modern Weaver is going to accept both. And so will any modern Picatinny. So as long as your gear is modern, you're not going to have any problem. They're almost interchangeable. The big difference is Picatinny is standardized by the military, the U.S. military. And so if you want something that's quote-unquote mil-spec, Picatinny is the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Only other types of rails, and like we said before, the advantages to this style is that cross slot. So your accessories don't move under recoil, which is a really nice feature.
And you have some ability to kind of move things around from slot to slot, so you can make some adjustments to how your, where your scope bases fit and where your scope fits just by moving to different cross slots.
Right.
As opposed to the older style of rifle mounts, which you had the top of the receiver drilled and tapped and your base fit where it was drilled and tapped. And
that's,
you had
it.
Much less room to move things around.
That's right. Now,
another thing that is kind of handy with the Weaver and Picatinny style is, because of those cross slots, you can, if you take something off, you can put it back on in exactly the same spot every time, and you're not, you know, sliding back and forth a little bit trying to figure out exactly where you had it before.
That's right. And
a lot of them are numbered.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. That's right. A lot of them are actually numbered, so you know exactly where to put it back. Mm-hmm. Other than that, the only other types of rails or bases would be like brand specific. I know there are some rifles that come with very specific mounting systems, but we're not going to get into those because I don't think any of us here have any of those types of rifles. And if you do, hopefully you're the type of person who has looked into it for yourself and has figured out exactly how that works. I know there are some really cool ones where you can actually put the base on, line up your sight in your scope, but then recenter your crosshair over the center of the gun, which is something that we might talk about later. That can induce an error too if your scope isn't actually centered over your gun. So there are some very high-end rails and high-end rings that can really, you know, somebody who's really into precision shooting can really eliminate every variable. So other than that,
we also should, if you don't mind, I think we should talk about having rails that are canted, so they add a little bit of elevation.
That's a good point. Yes, I forgot about that.
So we have, like, I think 10, 20, maybe 30 MOA rails. And basically those, the higher the number, the more the scope rail is raised in the back relative to the front. And it's tipping the scope down towards the muzzle. So you're not using up as much of the vertical adjustment in your scope for shooting at long distances.
Yep. A lot of guys who are shooting, you know, 1,000 yards plus will get 20 MOA or 30 MOA rails put on their guns, so that, exactly like Brian said, you don't have to keep cranking that turret. It's already at 20 MOA, and now you can add, you know, the extra 60 that your scope has built into it to get you right out there.
Yep.
Absolutely. Very good point. The only other thing is, what do you get? Do you get a two-piece rail or do you get a one-piece rail? And there are advantages and disadvantages to both. Advantages to a one piece is that they are more rigid, and the advantage to the two piece is that it's lighter. It just doesn't add as much weight to your gun. So you have to decide.
In the case of a bolt action rifle, it leaves the action more open for ejecting rounds or putting rounds in through the top of the action.
That's right.
Can be difficult with a full rail because it kind of covers over that top of that action.
I actually found that with my Hog Hunter, actually Matt's Hog Hunter now, it doesn't come with a removable magazine. And so you load the rounds through the top. And we had a one-piece rail on there for a while, and we were like cutting our fingers trying to get rounds in and out of that magazine.
Yep.
So we went to a two-piece, and it's much easier now to get rounds in and out.
Absolutely.
That's cool. All right, so let's move on to scope rings then. And again, there's not a whole lot to talk about here except that understand that they come in different heights. And so you ideally want to get your scope as close to your bore vertically as you can, because that's going to help eliminate trajectory errors. So just to understand, when you go out, you know, most of them, if you buy your scope has like a 32 millimeter objective, you can get lows. If it has a 40, often you're going to need mediums. And if it's bigger than 50, you're going to need highs. But you can talk to your local gun store, or you can talk online, or you can, you know, go on wherever your favorite gun forum, and you'll be able to find out the right rings that you need there. The only other thing to consider there is, what style do you get? Do you get one screw per side? Two per side, three, you know, do you want cantilever ones? Do you want ones that are offset? There's all kinds of different rings out there. We can't talk about them all, but
There's one that I'd like to mention.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, Owen.
No. I was going to ask a question, so why don't you go ahead and mention it, and I'll ask my question.
There's this one particular type of scope ring that the top part of the ring clamps onto one side of the bottom part, and then two screws hold it on the other side. I've always found those very difficult, because when you start to tighten them down, it torques the scope, and the scope ends up going from level to
not level. That is my least favorite style.
Yeah.
For that reason,
exactly.
I would
avoid those.
Yep.
Now, Trevor, are you talking the ones that are actually just hinged on one side and only have one screw?
They're hinged, but they're not permanently fixed hinged. So you kind of clip them in.
Yeah, in part, but yeah. I agree with you. Those work the least best.
The least, yes, I like that.
Yes.
So I've had people tell, because I'm looking at potentially getting a scope for my M305, something a little higher end, and I've heard people say, oh, you want to make sure you get good, you know, high quality rings to go with them.
Right.
What difference does it really make whether you have, you know, $20 rings or $100 rings?
You can, it all comes down to how well the part that holds on to the scope is machined, as I understand it. There's variations in the machining process, and sometimes they won't be exactly perpendicular to the other ring, and you'll sometimes actually dent your scope. I've done that before, and Trevor has a great way of getting rid of that problem, don't you, Trevor?
Yeah, I've got the Wheeler Engineering level scope mounting system with the lapping bar. And what that kind of does is that turns your $20 rings into $100 rings. Not really, but in the Magpul Dynamics precision rifle video, Owen, they cover rings. And one of the things that the instructor in that video says, there are a few things that, you know, you actually get what you pay for. And good scope rings, you do get what you pay for because of the precision put into them. Like Matthew said, they're machined. The tolerances are very high. If it's supposed to fit a 30-millimeter tube, it really does. And he says when you get into something like the LaRue Tactical, they ask him, do you lap your rings? And he says, you know, when you buy something like LaRue Tactical, you actually don't have to lap them. So if you get cheaper rings, it's always good to lap them because it takes out any high spots and increases the surface area that actually contacts the scope and helps.
What's lapping?
Oh, okay. Lapping is when you apply a lapping compound, which is basically like a putty version of sandpaper. It's like a toothpaste, very, very gritty, and it comes in different grits. I've got 220 grit. You just dip your finger into it like lip balm and coat it on put some on your rings, the top and the bottom. And then you take this steel bar, which is 1 inch or 30 millimeter, depending on the size of your rings, and you lap them. You move the bar forward and backwards in the rings and slowly tightening a little bit as you go until you've removed about, it says something like maybe up to 80% of the surface. Like if they're anodized aluminum, the anodizing comes off. So what that lapping does is it's basically sanding your rings to eliminate any high spots. And and then it also, not just high spots, but once they're on the rifle, if they're not perfectly lined up with each other, the lapping bar will ensure that they are true to one another.
So you mount the base part of the rings on, and it stays there like on as you would want to have them, and then you lap them, put your scope in, tighten down the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You lap the top that's of cool. the rings as well.
I'd always heard that term, and I kind of figured that's what it was, but I wasn't 100% sure. I don't have any guns that are high enough end that have scopes on them to really worry about it. I think the only gun I have a scope on other than the M305 is a 22. So,
right. Well, see, yeah, I spend more time working on the cheap guns to try and increase their accuracy than I do the high end guns. So if I've got a $40 scope and a $20 set of rings, I'll level that scope and lap that because that scope and those rings need all the help they can get.
That's right. A good point.
Yeah.
So actually mounting the scope, then that moves us on to our next topic here. One of the most important things when mounting the scope is making sure that the scope is actually level. And Trevor, you were talking about your level system. That's where you have a bubble level that actually is placed on the gun and then placed on the scope. And then you can go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, and then you center both bubbles, and that way you know that the scope is actually centered properly. And the importance of leveling it is, if your scope is canted, either left or right, understand that when you adjust it, when you adjust the elevation, if it's canted, you're actually adjusting the windage as well. A minute amount, but it's enough that you will notice over distance. So it's really, really important to get that scope just as absolutely perpendicular as you possibly can.
It also has an effect on windage. If you are holding your rifle and canting it to one side or the other, it will drift year-round to that side that you're canting. So let's say you're tipping the rifle to the right. Your shots are going to go off to the right, and the farther out, the farther right they're going to go. So if you get the crosshairs in your rifle level and you hold it level, you're not going to get those left or right deviations out to distance.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the key components to shooting precision is making sure that your barrel and your scope are absolutely in line vertically. And that's what I was talking about before, where there are actually rings available that will actually center the crosshair over the center of the bore of your rifle. Because once you think of this, you put your scope on. Well, from the factory, it's set at zero, but your base isn't going to be set exactly zero to your barrel. And so you have to adjust it. Well, now that you've adjusted it, it's the center of your crosshair is no longer over your barrel. So now you have to move that crosshair back. We're talking very, very fine minutia here at this point. Like that's a degree of accuracy that I probably won't achieve unless I tried really hard. And let's be honest here, I'm probably not going to do that. So, you know, that's probably not something you need to worry about, but that just understand that that is something that exists. And so leveling your scope is just one step that you can take to help ensure that you're going to get as much precision out of your gun as you possibly can.
And there's a couple different rings that can help you with that as well. There's a set of rings from Millet where you can actually slide the ring against whatever base you've selected. And because there's tightening screws on either side, so you can back off one side and move actually the whole scope over. It's also useful if you've found that when your scope is windage, you've used up a bunch of the available windage because things are kind of offset. That's important too, because you'd like to have everything when the scope is zeroed, it be close to the middle of the adjustment range. Yep. There's also rings from Burris called Signature Z rings, which have inserts that fit inside the ring and actually they're a little bit thicker. And so you can add either elevation by putting a thicker one at the back than in the front and kind of canting the scope up and down. Or if you have, again, if you're offset, you can put one on the left side in the front and one on the right side in the back and kind of tip the scope a little bit within those rings so it tends to be more straight and level.
So it's just kind of like a factory shim.
Yeah.
Kind of system. Yeah.
And with those signature Zs, you don't have to lap anything because you can't really lap the inserts because they're not going to stay in place while you're lapping. So
Yeah.
They are what they are.
Interesting. Because I had to shim the M3 just because of the height of the, I assume because of the height of the rings I had, there wasn't enough adjustment in the cheap scope that I have on it. So I actually had to shim the front. I just cut a piece of brass. I had some brass in the shop, some brass sheeting. I just cut a piece and curved it to the same curve as the ring and set it down in there. But
hey, gunsmiths have been doing that since scopes were invented. That's a perfectly valid
exactly. It's a good, but I wouldn't want to do it. You know,
it'd be better just to have precision. It done. Yep.
Yeah.
So, well, the next thing to consider when you're mounting your scope is your eye relief, and eye relief is simply mounting the scope fore and aft, so front and back on your rail, so that whenever you look through it, you're getting a full picture in the rear lens. We're going to talk about exit pupil in a couple minutes, but essentially is you want to make sure that your eye is intersecting the exit pupil exactly where it belongs, so that you get a complete image. You don't have any black sort of negative area in the scope viewfinder, for lack of a better term, the rear lens. So what most scope manufacturers recommend, at least the ones that I've been reading up on recently, is if you have a variable power scope, put it on the middle setting. So if it's a 3-9, put it at 6. And you can do the math for all the other variables that are out there, but put it in the middle and then adjust your eye relief to that. And then that will put you in the sweet spot because your eye relief will change slightly from your minimum magnification to your maximum magnification.
And then if depending on the rifle and that you have it mounted on, like if you have it on a hard kicking rifle, you might want to lean towards having that scope a little bit further away, because when that scope comes back and leaves a giant welt or a cut over your eye, it doesn't really matter if you've seen a little bit of black around the outside of your optical view.
That's a good point.
Everyone else is going to be seeing a lot of black around the outside of your eye.
Yeah, that's exactly. Right. Yes. Yeah. That can be a bad thing.
Yep. So. That's a good point. And then the last thing about mounting is torque settings. You can get, Trevor has a inch, is it inch pounds? It's a torque driver that measures as low as like 1 or 2 inch pounds. And you can mount the scope, using this, basically it's a torque driver is what it is.
Yeah, it's a torque wrench that comes with the scope mounting kit. So they also include a leaflet that has the recommended torques for like the torque range, weight, whatever for your rings and your bases. So for common bases, it says torque between 18 and 20 inch pounds for rings between 28 and 30 or whatever the case may be.
Yep. And it's something to bear in mind because I've found most people will either crank them down way too tight or they just won't crank them down enough. And there is a happy medium. You do need to make sure they're very tight, but not too tight. Because too tight means, again, bent scopes. You can break things. You can break rings. You can bend scope tubes. You can do all kinds of damage if you put too much force into it. So make sure that you're putting in the appropriate amount of force. You know, if you don't have the ability to go get a torque driver for yourself, just be moderate. But be firm too. It's, you know, you can't teach somebody how much it, you know, 20 inch pounds of torque is, but, you know, you're just going to have to kind of figure that out. Just don't go too crazy, but make sure it is tight enough. If your scope's moving on you, it's not tight enough.
And you
if
know,
your scope is dented, you've gone too far.
There you go. So go as soon as it dents, then back off one
back
turn.
It up.
Yeah.
No.
Then it'll be loose because you dented it.
Yeah. Once you dent it, then you give it another half turn.
Leave it at that point. Look, I'll be honest. I have a scope that has been dented because I was Mr. Monkey Arm on it and I just went crazy. It doesn't move. It's never coming off and I'll never sell that scope. I couldn't in good conscience because I've damaged it. It doesn't affect it. I mean, it hasn't damaged it to the point where it's not operable. It hasn't interfered with its operation at all. It's a cosmetic flaw now, but you can be darn sure it's not moving because it's actually the ring is dented right into the scope tube. So it's got its own little setting. Be careful.
And for the listeners, if you're only going to mount one or two scopes or you're not confident and you don't want to go in a bunch of money on tools and stuff, don't be afraid to just take it to a gunsmith and pay a little bit and have it done right. So then your scope's not moving around on you as you shoot. And you can just kind of focus on, at least you know that's been done right and you can just roll on from there.
That's right. Yeah. Your local gunsmith will be able to do that for you for a minimal fee. It's not very expensive.
No.
No. He'll probably charge you half of what my kit cost me, and then you'll have the kit forever, and you can help your buddies out too.
Yeah,
that's why I'm glad Trevor bought it.
Yeah, it all depends on your situation, but don't think you have to do it yourself if that's not your thing. But honestly, it's not hard. I've mounted lots of scopes. I've never lapped them. I've never bothered. I've never had a problem. But you using the torque settings are good because it's nice to know you're not going to break crap.
Yeah, and you can buy the Wheeler Engineering torque wrench on its own as well, and it's like $40 or something.
Yeah, I definitely need to invest in that, especially if I ever decide to buy more scopes, because I don't want to bend anymore.
Now, see, I got one because I needed one for the boat. So,
well, there
and
you go.
I just kind of ended up in my gun room for mounting scopes and mounting actions and that kind of thing. So that's how I justified the expense of that torque wrench. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be buying mine specifically for scopes.
Yeah, that's okay.
They come in inch pounds and foot pounds. Yours is probably foot pounds, I imagine.
No, this was inch pounds.
Oh, good for you.
This is for the drain plugs on my rather expensive motor for my boat. So I made the investment because I bought a boat motor. And it's worth more than my entire gun collection. So it seemed worthwhile at that point.
Good call. Good call. Well, let's talk about some of the actual features that you'll find on scopes.
Lenses are good.
Lenses are very good. We're not going to talk about the most obvious ones right away. One of the most overlooked ones is the fast focus ring. And that is the ring that's at the back on the very rear lens. And what that does is that allows you to put the reticle into sharp focus. You can, without adjusting that, see that reticle focus sharply. But what you're doing is you're forcing your eye to focus on something that's not at a natural focus point, and you will get eye strain. It's very important to look at something off in the far distance and then quickly transition to looking through your scope And if your reticle is blurry, you can adjust that ring, usually to the positive. At least for myself, it's always been to the positive. You move it to the positive, and that reticle will come into focus. That has nothing to do with focusing on the target, has nothing to do with parallax error, has nothing to do with that. All it is making sure that your eye is focusing on the reticle without straining your eye. Anything to add to that, gentlemen?
You say that people overlook it, but I look through it every time I look through a scope.
Ah, you're hilarious. A lot of people overlook actually adjusting it.
Yes, and I know it's there, but I don't think I've ever adjusted it on any scope I've ever had.
But the first thing I do when I get a new scope is adjust that, and I tell you that before I realized what it was for and how it worked, I would come away from long shooting sessions with like a headache because my eye was straining. And since I've learned that, never been a problem since.
Yep. No, and that's, it's important for people to know because people may be having trouble with that and not realize that adjustment's even there.
That's right. So, and it's on just about every scope I've ever seen. And it may not be obvious. Sometimes you just turn the entire rear bell and it mm-hmm. it'll change the focal point there. So make sure you do look into that if you have that opportunity. The next thing we'll talk about is finger adjustable versus tool adjustable turrets. So who wants to take this one?
So there's useful versus useless. Okay. yeah, there's in order to zero your scope, your scope will have adjustments for windage. That's left and right and elevation up and down. Early scopes and a lot of hunting scopes, you take the caps off the turrets and you just see basically a screw head. So, and it's not big enough really it's too big really to use much of a screwdriver, but you would use, say, a coin.
That's most of them say use a quarter, and that's what they're sort of designed for, because most guys have a quarter in the pocket.
Yeah, and I mean, crazy to have a screwdriver. That's just nuts. But anyway, and so you just use that to adjust the zero point so that your bullets are hitting in the middle or in the middle of your crosshair, or more correctly, your crosshair is adjusted to be pointing at where the bullets are going to hit when you fire.
That's right. You're not adjusting where your bullets hit. You're adjusting where your crosshair is looking.
Yes, exactly. now, and then for the old style hunting scopes, then you just put the cap on and you're not really going to adjust that because it's not easy to adjust.
Most hunting rifles, you'll set sight them in usually a 200 yard zero, and that's going to give you a point blank range, which means a distance that you can shoot a typical size animal without holding high or holding low, anywhere from 50 to almost 300 yards. So that's why you don't really need to worry about, you know, with a hunting rifle, you find detail, find adjustments up and down. You're just basically sighting it in to be able to hit the boiler room of a deer from 50 to 300 yards. And once you've done that, you don't need to ever touch it again.
Yeah. Now, for if you're shooting longer distance or you're more interested in getting a precise zero for a given range you're shooting at, or say you're shooting a competition, they have what's called target turrets. And those are not capped, and they stick up a little bit, so they're easy to be turned by hand. Or with your fingers, rather. And typically they have graduations on them, so you can see how much you're adjusting things. You can either count clicks or count as the little hash marks move around, so you know how much you've made that adjustment. Those can slip off. Once you've zeroed the gun, you can typically put those turrets back to a zero point, so you know, okay, this is where I'm zeroed. And from there, you can start making adjustments for distance or range or whatever else. The downside in theory is you could bump them and adjust them so that your scope is no longer pointing at where you intended to. But technology has moved along to the point now that they tend to be fairly robust, and they're becoming more and more common for all types of use because it's just simple.
They are. And the nice thing is, like you said, Brian, the ones that are re-zeroable, all you got to do is quickly glance down and ensure that the tick is on the zero, and you know that you're zeroed and you haven't bumped your scope. And mm-hmm. the other thing to consider is that some scopes will come with coverable finger turrets. And
yes.
So you can take the covers off if you're shooting in a competition and you need fast access to your adjustments. Or if you're out hunting, you can put the caps on and not have to worry about accidentally bumping them. So that's something to consider as well.
A bit of both, yeah.
So
now,
go ahead.
One thing with those resettable turrets, one of the things that I like are ones that you actually have to use a tool to back off set screws, and then you can adjust it. Some of them are simple to re-zero, simple like you pull it up and spin it and it will be re-zeroed. and then you can really easily lose things, in my opinion. I wouldn't go that route. I like something that takes a little bit of effort. Once I've zeroed it, I'd like it to stay zeroed. If it spins, at least I'll be able to say, okay, it's moved a little bit. I can adjust it back. It hasn't just gone at random.
Right.
That's a hassle.
So. That's a good point. Although it is really nice to be able to just pull up on the turret, move it back to zero, and drop it. I've seen Trevor do that on his, and I thought that was a really neat feature. But you do make a good point. It could be adjusted without you wanting it to be adjusted if you're not careful. But I think it's fairly positive, isn't it, Trevor? It doesn't really just kind of flop around on its own there. You really have to pull on it.
To you're talking about when you reset it? Yeah. You definitely have to. It's spring loaded. Yep. So you got to pull against that spring. Oh, geez, well over an eighth of an inch.
Okay.
Yeah, you got to get it way up there.
Which scope is that, Trevor? That has that feature for you?
My Viper has that, and possibly my old Diamondback had it too. These are both Vortexes.
And different scopes do it differently. Yeah,
my Loophole does it, but it's not spring loaded.
Yeah, you use an Allen key to take the turret off and then move it and put it back down, put it back on. That's how my Bushnell is. And if you watch my review video, you'll see exactly what we're talking about there. Yep. The other thing to consider is the adjustments themselves. Most scopes come with a quarter MOA adjustment. That means that for every click, the crosshair will move one quarter MOA. And a quarter MOA is one quarter inch at 100 yards or an eighth of an inch at 50 yards. But you do have to be careful. There are some manufacturers out there that produce scopes with half MOA adjustments. And if you inadvertently have one of those and think you have a quarter MOA adjustment, you will be chasing your groups all over the paper before you realize. I speak from experience. So just make sure you look on the scope itself and see what the adjustments are, if it's a quarter MOA or half MOA. And like I said, it's an inch at 100 yards, and then just do the math from there back. You know, if you're at 50 yards, it's double that. And I don't know, do we want to get into explaining what a minute of angle is? That's what MOA stands for.
Yeah, I think
we sort of have to.
It's a 60th of an angle.
Yeah,
60th of a degree. So imagine a circle. It has 360 degrees in it. Take 1 degree out of that. So that's a very small sliver of the pie. And now break up that degree into 60 more segments. That's a minute of angle. So that whenever you click the scope, you're moving it 1/4 of 1 minute of 1 degree of a circle. So that's a very small amount of travel. And fortunately for us who are not so math inclined, it works out very nicely to almost exactly an inch at 100 yards. A minute of angle is 2 inches at 200 yards, 3 inches at 300 yards, and so on and so forth. At 50 yards, you double it. At 25 yards, you're quadrupling it.
Yeah, four times, yeah.
So, you know, if you're zeroing at 50 yards with your 22, just remember each click is an eighth MOA. If you're zeroing at 100 yards with your center fire, remember each click is a quarter inch instead of an eighth of an inch. So, and then from there, it's just a matter of measuring where your group is. And then where do you want it to impact? Measure those in inches, convert that to your number of clicks that you need. Do your clicks, and if you have a good scope, it'll be exactly where you want it.
Now, there's another major type of scope adjustment measurement, and that's MRADs. And that's basically a metric measurement, so to speak. And one MRAD is equivalent to...
I can't remember. I actually just looked this up recently. I can't remember.
I think it's 10 centimeters at 1,000 meters. Something like that is how it's based on.
Right.
But it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
It's generally the same. It's just slightly different. Now, a lot of scopes now will have adjustments that are in either MRADs or MOA, and they also have hash marks within the reticle that are also either MOA or MRADs. Those are my favorite kinds so that they match. So if you're making an adjustment, you see that you've made a hit somewhere that's this many hash marks away from where you intended, you can tell from that is how much angle that is, and you can dial in an adjustment and fix it.
That's right. Yep. The MOAs, the minute of angle, is the more prevalent and more common one for the average mid-range scope and low-end scope.
Absolutely.
The Miller Radians, the MRAD system, is definitely a high-end, and it's a relatively new system, as I understand it. It's not that new. By relatively, I mean it was introduced within the last 100 years, as opposed to MOAs being around for like thousands of years. So, it is a more of a military application, as I understand it. More of the military uses the MRAD system. So, if you're into tactical shooting and military style, then that might be the type of scope you want to look at. Otherwise, the minute of angle style, the old style, is just fine too.
The MILRAD was actually developed by artillery in the First World War.
There you go. Very cool. Yeah. And you were just talking about hash marks being on the reticle. And a lot of people or a lot of manufacturers will actually put hash marks both windage and elevation, but most often elevation, and they'll set them up as a bullet drop compensator, meaning that if you've zeroed your gun at a specific distance, the next drop down, the next hash down, will be another specified distance. It's usually 100 yards, 200 yards, 300 yards, and 500 yards, or whatever. But that's something that we should talk about, too, is the bullet drop compensator, because that makes holding over your targets at different ranges much easier to do.
Absolutely. Yep.
And the other thing that a lot of them will do is put in windage hash marks. And so if you know what the subtensions are, and the subtension is simply a fancy word for how far apart those hash marks are. You can, you know, for instance, I know Vortex, they're 2 minutes of angle apart. So if you can do the math in your head for how much wind there is, you can just simply use that as well, even in a wind situation, elevation and windage, just by moving your scope a little bit. You don't have to worry about moving your turrets. You just aim off, and your Kentucky elevation or your Kentucky windage there is almost done for you, because you have the crosshairs or the hash marks to actually look at. Makes it much easier to shoot longer distances when you're holding off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. An illuminated reticle is just simply a reticle where there's a small light inside the tube, and operating on a battery, it will actually cast some light on the reticle to help you see it whenever it's dark. And so I find a lot of the lower-end scopes have that as sort of a feature to get you to buy it, and they're usually poorly executed. But done properly in a high-end scope, illuminated reticle is something that can be invaluable if you're shooting in dim situations.
Yeah. Or if you're – even if you're hunting, and it, because in the woods, you can lose a dark crosshair against just shadows. So
absolutely,
an illuminated reticle has a lot of help there too.
Yeah. Yep. So now let's get into – side focus and adjustable objectives and parallax. A lot of people don't know what parallax is, or if they do, don't understand it properly, and I may even be in that boat myself, but I think I have a good grasp on it. So I think I'm going to try to explain it. And Brian, you jump in here if I'm going off astray here, because I know that you know quite a bit about this topic too. And Trevor and Owen, jump in with questions before we go too far if something's confusing you. So quickly, what parallax error is stand at your kitchen window and take a Sharpie and draw a dot on your neighbor's front door. And then take a step to the left. Your dot's no longer on the front door, is it? That's parallax error. It's whenever what you're looking at and what you're looking through are not lined up properly. And the nice thing about scopes is they actually take the parallax error and they set it at a specific distance. So rimfire scopes are usually set at 50 yards. Centerfire scopes are usually set at 100 yards. And what that means is when you look through the scope, the reticle itself is actually projected at the same focal plane as the target if you're shooting at a 100-yard target. So let's just talk centerfire scopes. If you're shooting at a 100-yard target, the reticle in your eye, as you look at it, is actually on the same focal plane, which means that if your eye isn't centered perfectly behind the scope, it doesn't matter. Because the reticle and the target are on the same focal plane, the reticle center is always going to be in the center of your target as long as that's where you hold it. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yep. Makes sense to me.
Trevor and Owen?
Sure.
Yep.
Trevor's probably on Facebook buying a gun.
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay, so what adjustable objectives are and what side focus is two different ways. It's actually the same way. It's just one has a much more linkage in it. You're moving the front lens or one of the front lenses, and you're actually adjusting the distance of that focal plane of the reticle. And so if you're somebody like me who likes to shoot at varying distances, sometimes I'm shooting at 10 yards, sometimes I'm shooting at 200. Having the ability to adjust where the reticle is being focused or being projected really allows me to not worry about where my eye is behind the scope. Ideally, I'm always going to be in the same position, but I'm a human, not a robot, and so it's not always going to be. So eliminating that error allows me to focus more on keeping the crosshair on the target, not having to worry about, is there going to be parallax error there? The adjustable objective is just simply turning the front bell left and right, and there'll be hash marks on there that will say, you know, 100 yards, 50 yards, 25 yards, 300 yards, whatever, and you just line up whatever distance you're at. And the side focus is simply, it looks like a third turret, except that instead of adjusting your elevation or your windage, it's actually adjusting that lens via a bunch of mechanical linkage inside the scope. And so you can do the same thing there. And the nice thing about that is you can actually keep your eye behind the scope, and you can adjust that side focus without having to really reach up and grab that front bell, and you can actually dial it in exactly by simply moving your head side to side and dialing that until the crosshair is staying centered right on your target without deviating from it.
Exactly. Yep. And that's key. Those marks on your objective or in your side focus turret are approximations.
They are very approximate.
You really should just check. And that's all you do. You set it and then you look at your target and you kind of move your head around behind that scope. And if your crosshair moves with your eye, you still have parallax error. So you have to keep adjusting it until that's fixed.
If you watch the video I just put out, I actually hold the camera behind the scope with a large amount of parallax error induced, and you can see the crosshair is moving all the way across a sheet of paper at 50 yards. That's 8 inches of error. And then whenever I dial it into the right distance, you see that even though, you know, the crosshair and the target are sort of wiggling as the camera moves, they're not moving in relation to each other. The crosshair stays exactly on the target as the camera moves back and forth. And that's parallax error eliminated.
Yeah. Now, it's more prevalent at closer distance than it is at longer distance, just because it's more a ratio of how much that error is relative to the overall distance. But again, you might as well adjust it out, because it can, just without you realizing it, it can induce an error and your gun is not actually pointed where you think it is.
That's right. And I did the math. I watched somebody else do the math online a couple of episodes ago, and I came up with a rule of thumb that tends to be about, with your typical 3-9 power scope, your rule of thumb is for every 100 yards off that your parallax error is past 100, you're going to get about 15 millimeters of error. So it's really not that big a deal for people who are out hunting. But people who are looking for dime-sized groups at 200 yards, your parallax is something that you really want to focus on and make sure that you can get dialed in exactly where you want it.
And again, it's only applicable if you can sight on something at the distance you want to shoot it at. So say if you're at a slow fire rifle competition at a known distance, you have the ability to make those adjustments. If you're out in a more dynamic situation, you don't have time to do that kind of thing. So you have to kind of set it somewhere in the middle and go with it and just be confident you're going to hit what you're going to hit.
Yeah, and like I said, rim fire is usually set at 50 and center fire is at 100, and there's good reason for those numbers, because those are the numbers that tend to work quite well. You really don't have to worry about them, you know, beyond, you know, anybody who's not shooting competition level shooting, you really don't have to worry about it at that distance. Yeah. So
something else I've noticed, you will get scopes that have that adjustment, the parallax adjustment, typically at 10 power and up. Lower power scopes often don't have that.
That is true. And I was actually very pleasantly surprised to find that Bushnell 2-7 that I ordered had it, because that is a feature that I really enjoy having on my scopes. So, look around if you are looking for a lower power one that has that. They do exist out there. But Brian's right. It's rare. It's usually the higher ends or the higher magnifications that have that.
And just because your scope doesn't have that adjustment doesn't mean that it doesn't exhibit parallax. It's just that the parallax error will appear to be less. I have a fixed 3-power scope that has no adjustments on it for parallax whatsoever, and I do note that it does have parallax, especially at close range.
Yep, Brian's right. The lower the magnification, the less the parallax error. The higher the magnification, the greater the parallax error, which tends to be why the higher magnification scopes have the parallax error adjustment. Mm-hmm. So we've already talked about eye relief. We've already talked a little bit about fixed versus variable power scopes. The exit pupil. What do you know about exit pupils there, Brian?
Bigger is better.
Bigger is better is the perceived, is the general consensus, yeah?
Yeah.
Very, very easily to remember what your exit pupil is. It's simply your aperture or your objective divided by the magnification. So a 10 power scope with a 40 millimeter objective has a 4 millimeter exit pupil.
But Matt, what's an 10. Objective?
Oh, the objective is the front lens.
Yeah, okay. That's right. Yeah. I just thought we should include the
That's a good point. Yep.
Yeah.
So the objective is the front lens, also known as the aperture, the front aperture. The aperture is just simply anything that accepts light. So
And the bigger that is, the more forgiving in terms of eye relief and where you can see a clear picture and also how bright that picture will be.
That's it. The bigger the exit pupil, the brighter it is. Now bear in mind that the average human eye is only, it only dilates to a maximum of what, 8 to 9 millimeters? So any exit pupil that's bigger than 8 to 9 millimeters is really bigger than it needs to be.
Yeah, I think your numbers are off, but your concept is correct. I don't think your eye dilates to 8 millimeters. That's pretty big, I think. Okay. I could be wrong about that. Yeah, perhaps somebody who knows could tell us.
Sure.
Not 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
That's just under a centimeter, so that's not too unreasonable. 8 millimeters is just under a centimeter. I think it's
but that's a big pupil.
Yeah, that's
no, and 8 millimeters is a lot less than a centimeter. Oh no, it is just a little bit, isn't it? Yeah. Sorry, I'm thinking
there's 10.
My mistake.
There you
I'm
go.
Sorry, Owen. You are correct. I am wrong.
Woohoo! Now we have another one.
it's recorded too.
Yeah.
Well, hey, if I make a mistake that bad, I have to fall on my sword real quick.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're merciless at that point.
Yeah. 8 out of 10. Yeah, that's not close. Oh, yes, it is. It's very close. Oh.
So, most scopes in their specifications will list what the exit pupil is. And so have a look at that. Have a gander. If it's like, 1 millimeter, you may want to move on to another scope because it's going to be virtually impossible to keep your eye exactly where you need it to see a good picture.
That would be like those really old rimfire scopes that were as big as a pencil.
But the nice thing about having the exit pupil that small is it's really, really hard to get parallax error. Because your eye has to be directly behind the scope in order to see anything.
There you go. I hadn't thought about that.
So that is something to consider. A really big exit pupil will actually allow you a bigger parallax error. But, that's just we're getting into some finer points there. I don't think you really need to worry about that too much. Just remember, bigger is better with exit pupils. We talked about the objective, what that is.
Not just exit pupils, but specifically to this discussion, exit pupils.
Right.
Bigger is better.
Okay. Bigger is better. So we talked about the objective. I'm just going through the notes here. Zero is the next thing we're going to talk about, how to actually zero your gun. So you're at the range. What's the sight-in procedure? What do you do first when you have a new scope to sight in, Brian?
Well, it depends on the type of rifle I'm using. If it's, say, a bolt action of some type, I will mount the scope and put it in some type of steady rest at the range, and I'll pull the bolt out. And I will look through the bore of the rifle at the target and generally adjust things so the rifle is resting such that the bore is pointed directly at the center of my target.
And that's called?
Bore sighting.
Imagine.
Crazy how that comes.
And there are different ways of bore sighting. For instance, anybody with a semi-auto probably won't be able to bore sight because you can't stick your eye inside the ejection port. So you can get...
Cool if you could. If you were some kind of alien, you could pull your eye out and shove it in the action, but no.
You can get lasers. You can get little things that stick in the end of your barrel that project an image. There's all kinds of different ways to bore sight. So if that's an option, I highly recommend bore sighting before you start shooting.
Now, can I add a caveat?
If
you're sticking a laser in the end of your bore for bore sighting,
take it out before you shoot.
Just do that. Don't ask me how I know. Just take it out. Just go with me on this one, and we'll carry on from here.
That is definitely an important thing to remember. If you don't have the ability to bore sight, what I recommend doing for sighting in is starting with your target very, very close. One of my favorite things to do is I will just shoot, especially on a day that's dry, I'll just shoot at the berm with a low magnification because I will see where the dust kicks up and I'll be able to kind of get an idea. But if you don't have that ability, start with a very large piece of paper up very close. I'm talking 10 yards-ish. and that will make sure that whenever you pull the trigger, the bullet actually hits the paper, and then you can start dialing in your scope, because there's nothing more frustrating than shooting at 50 yards and not even hitting the paper and not knowing which way to adjust your scope.
Exactly. And a simple way to do that, if you do, typically people will do that at 25 yards, say, and if you can get your rifle in a steady rest, take a shot. Then, assuming that the gun hasn't moved a whole bunch, just dial the scope to point at where that bullet went.
Yep.
And you'll be much closer with your second shot than you were with your first.
That's right. So. And then, whenever you are dialing for actual precision, shoot at least 3 shots, and I recommend 5. Unless you have a rifle that's able to put those, you know, the bullets into, like, cloverleaf pattern very, very close, shoot at least 5 shots to make sure that you're zeroing the scope's reticle near the center of that group. That's that's kind of the idea. I understand that most rifles are not going to be high-end precision rifles, and so you just want the reticle to be pointing at the center of the group, because that's going to give you the biggest chance of hitting what you're aiming at.
And that's important for people to realize. You don't need the bullet to land right where the crosshair is. If your bullets are spread out in a group, you want your scope to be centered in the middle, roughly, of where those 3 or 5 holes is. That's right. Your zero.
I remember at the range 3 or 4 years ago now, there was an older guy there, and he had an old bolt action 300 Winchester Magnum, something or other, some big gun anyway. And he was shooting it at 100 yards, sort of off a sandbag, but standing and leaning over. It was a really weird way to shoot. I could tell there was no way he was getting any sort of accuracy out of it. But anyway, he would shoot, he'd go down to the 100 yards, see where the bullet hole was, and then adjust the scope, shoot again, and it would be in a completely different spot. And he was getting so frustrated. And before I had the chance to go up and say, well, maybe you should try shooting, you know, 3 or 4 shots and you know, go for the center of the group, he actually ran out of ammo. He only had like 10 rounds, and then he was gone. I was like, oh, the poor guy. He thinks his gun is completely inaccurate and his scope is broken, but all he needed to do was shoot a group and aim for the center of the group. So
now, was he also using 10 random rounds that he pulled out of his pocket with all different weights and manufacture?
That, you know, I didn't look that closely. Because he had an old battered box of ammo that looked like it was from the 50s.
Okay, because I've seen that a lot too, where people will just come, oh, here's a bunch of ammo for my gun.
I'll zero it in with this. Yeah.
And they're shooting just random stuff, and there's no way they're going to get a zero of anything, because there's the gun can't zero with putting different ammunition through it at every shot.
Yeah, understand that different ammo, different bullet weights, different velocities produce different trajectories. And so your zero is going to be in different places. So where do you zero your rifle? And the answer to that is, what type of rifle do you have and what are you shooting it for?
Yep.
If it's a hunting rifle, like I said earlier, a 200-yard zero is very, very common. AR-15s, Trevor likes a 36-yard zero. I like a 50-yard zero, because that gives you, you know, zero to 250 yards or so center of mass on a target. You know, it just depends. And so look up.
It also depends on your scope.
It absolutely.
So
that we can't really give you an answer for.
I have a scope that's designed to be zeroed at 100, and I just make all my adjustments off that zero.
There you go. Yeah, you can do that, especially if you have a scope with a bullet drop compensator. You want to make sure that you zero the main crosshair at the known distance, and that way you can use the bullet drop compensator effectively. The most effective way to figure out what your trajectory is, though, you do need a chronograph. You're going to have to chronograph your bullets. You can use what's written on the side of the box. It's usually pretty close. But then just Google online, or on Google there, online trajectory calculator. And there are some really cool ones that'll pop up. Vortex has one. JBM has one. There's a bunch of them out there. And you can punch in your numbers, punch in how high your scope is over your bore, and it'll print out or give you a graph of what your trajectory is going to look like. And then you can use that, tweak the numbers, and set it up so that you can come up with a trajectory that you're happy with and that you'll know what all the distances are.
Now, and something else, you'd mentioned getting zeroed at 100 yards or a 200-yard zero for hunting. And that is very common, but 200-yard ranges are not. So what you can do is, using that ballistic calculator, you can figure out what your trajectory would be for a 200-yard zero at 100 yards, like how high that bullet would have to hit above your point of aim.
Yeah, it's like 2 inches at 100 yards or something like that. It's going to be like that. Or a lot of guys, actually, I see them do this, is they'll put the target at 20 yards and they shoot an inch low. and they know it at an inch low, it's 2 inches high at 100 and three, yeah. you know, dead there's, on at yeah, two. The problem with that is you don't actually, you have to be able to verify that. That's a good starting point. But shooting at 20 yards, that's not going to tell you for sure that you're actually dialed in properly at 100. I mean, mm-hmm. errors multiply with distance, and shooting at 20 yards, it's easy. You know, you can put your bullets right on top of each other, but that's because the errors are very, very small at that distance. The bullet hasn't had a chance to deviate from its flight path. Yep. So you really do need to stretch it out and verify what your zeros actually are if you get a chance.
If that's available to you.
Yeah.
If,
but at least 100. At least 100.
Yeah. Unless you've already verified that at some other point, and then yep. say you're going to travel to hunt, you want to do a re-zero. Well, maybe the distance you have is something relatively close, yep. but if you know that at this close distance, that equates to this distance zero, I'm good to go, then you can work with that. It's available to you.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Well, I think we nailed just about everything we possibly can with scopes for this episode anyway.
Well, we certainly there's so much you can.
We certainly scratched the surface.
Yes. The surface is definitely scarred up and, marred. It's definitely used at this point.
Awesome. Well, why don't we move on to shout-outs and goodbyes. So let's start with Owen, because I hear his battery's dying on his laptop because somebody forgot to bring his charging cable with him. You have any shout-outs or anything you want to throw in here, Owen, before you completely fall off the face of the planet?
Too late.
Oh, he's on his phone, it sounds like.
Yeah, I had to switch over to my phone.
Oh, wow. Your audio is awesome.
And by awesome, he means horrible.
It's actually not that bad. And if you kept talking, we'd get used to it. I'd ask you to pull your phone a little bit farther away from your mouth. But it actually works quite well. That's nice to know that we have that option.
It doesn't hurt. It doesn't help that I'm in the bathroom because my wife's in the other room watching TV.
I was wondering what the echo was. Don't flush. Please don't flush. Oh, that is classic. I love
it. You know, it's funny because I was going to send Toby an email message about bathroom breaks on the podcast, but now I can't really say anything.
We really can't say a thing.
I'm just going to shut up.
Oh, it's terrible. All right. Well, Owen, no shout-outs for you then?
No shout-outs, I don't think.
Okay. Trevor, how about you?
To our buddy Andy Shan, listener from Halifax, for winning the Classic Division at Spring Bang.
Hey, good job, man.
Yeah, I was vindicated. Matt Lorette and I were invited to stay with him and travel back and forth with him to the match this weekend, and we both bailed on him, but they got hit with such a bad storm that he actually, in his huge 4x4 Chev truck, I'm assuming he was driving his truck, maybe not, but they had to turn around. They couldn't make it to the second day of the match. The weather was so bad and the roads were so bad that they actually couldn't make day two. So we possibly would have been stranded in Halifax until Monday morning.
I'm glad that didn't happen to you.
Yeah, but congratulations, Andy. Looks like that classic gun is running well, and so are you.
Very nice. Good job. Brian, got any shout-outs there?
I'm going to give this a shout out to Stacy, to Red Ranch, and to Ken Kowalski, because it's quite possible that we're all going to be listening to this right now in the van on the way to pick up some guy from the airport in Michigan.
Nice. So, I hope you're listening to yourself, listening to me, listening to you right now.
And it would be really funnier if that guy is in the van at the time we listen to this and I don't mention his name.
Right.
Because so that's just kind of how. He just deserves that.
He deserves to not be mentioned.
He does deserve
that. He that must not be mentioned.
Yes, but not that guy. Not the guy we talked about.
Not the Voldemort guy. No, oh, dang it. I said his name again. All right. Well, I don't have any shout-outs, so we're going to go ahead and wrap up. I do want to remind you all that next week is our 100th episode. We are hoping to have kind of a mailbag episode where you write in, ask us questions, ask us to, you know, comment on things or whatever. Just tell us a funny story, hunting story, shooting story, whatever you like. It's your episode is kind of what we're trying to say here. You're the listeners. You guys make this show possible, really.
And, tell us how you found out about Slamfire Radio.
Sure. I mean, those are always fun stories.
That would be a good one.
We got one really excellent audio submission from our humble correspondent, 10X.
Nice.
So that's always fun. If anybody else wants to send some in, that would be awesome.
Audio Archie submissions. Barry. Yep. Yep. They're
Jason,
always fun.
Jason, who drives the truck.
Yeah. Please do it while driving down a gravel road with your windows open, though.
Yeah.
Because that's the best kind of audio you can get. So yeah, so tune in next week for sure. Also check us out on, and the other podcasts on, the Crusader Podcast Network, and that's located at crusaderpodcast.com. Lots of really cool podcasts and other information available over there. Join both of our national firearms associations, the CSSA and the NFA. You know, it's got to be done. We got to support them, and they help us, and we need to help them. So sign up. And if you do, tell them that you signed up because of us, and also tell us that you signed up, because we love hearing that we're actually being effective at something other than driving you all away with long, boring scope talks. So check us out on Gun Owners of Canada. We have a neat little forum there where we're completely in charge, and we can say and ban whoever we like, and we never do that, though. So basically, you come on over there and keep Double Up Buck occupied, because he's always in there posting stuff. And so, you know, go keep him company. And we even talk back sometimes. So that's really cool. I also do post the show on CGN, Canadian Gun Nuts, and oftentimes it gets viewed like 6 or 7 times, you know, each time I post something.
Almost,
and so, so I'm like, oh, what's the point? And this week, for the first time ever, I was actually just beginning to give up hope, and I was just going to stop posting it there altogether, because I was like, what's the point? Not, you know, it's just wasting my time. But somebody actually posted something in there and said, hey, thanks for posting this here. I listen every week. And so that actually started a bit of a discussion. It's been viewed like 60 or 70 times now. So yay, we got a presence on CGN as well. So check us out there if you like. The last place I'm going to tell you to go is Facebook, because if you have Facebook and you haven't friended us yet, it's like you don't shop at the Calgary Shooting Center.
I don't think they can friend the show page.
Oh,
they
can like us. Like us. Go ahead and like us. So,
and if you've liked the Slamfire Radio page, you'd probably really like the Modern Rifleman Radio page, so you should go over and like them too.
That's true. Brian does a good show, or a good job on his show too. You should go check him out with his co-host there, Ken Kowalski. I think you're actually the co-host, but whatever.
You gotta ask Doc Wesson about that from the Gun Nation. Yeah,
all right,
man. Doc's got a PhD. And arguing with him, he said that Brian was the host. You gonna argue with a PhD?
I wouldn't.
No.
Well, I would.
Because I'm an engineer, I just argue with people on, you know, just on principle. So
Oh, fantastic. Well, that wraps up another show. This was supposed to be a short one, and it didn't turn out to be, because we got into all kinds of fun stuff. So sorry it went long, but we hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week with the 100th episode, so we will talk to you then.
So if you have any comments or questions for the show, please send an email to slamfireradio@gmail.com. Now go grab a gun and shoot something.
When the talking is over, it's time to get a gun.
Take your nuts shooting.
Again, it's protect them. Ah, it's a whole nother show.
Take somebody shooting. Protect your nuts. Take your nuts shooting. It makes perfect sense.
It's to some people.
Take someone shooting. Often shooting straight.
Wait, what is it you used to say there, Brian?
I didn't say take someone's nuts shooting.
Shoot safe. Safe is the important part.
This is the best ending ever, basically.
No, this is awful.
This is the best. Who doesn't like an awkward ending?
If we were professional, we would, like, you know, cut this and do it right until we had it right.
That's not going to happen.
If we were professional, you wouldn't have flushed a toilet for the love of
people. But you know what, though? Owen didn't contribute a lot to the show, but when he did, man, it was comic gold.
Yeah, or it was a serious question.
I'm usually good for a laugh.
Right, or he flushed a toilet, really. There was all kinds of great things he did. Why didn't you just go on your phone to begin with? Now your laptop's dead for the rest of your trip.
I don't need it for the rest of the trip. I only brought it for that.
Oh, well, perfect. Well, that almost worked out well. If only Brian and
I had
been less wordy.
You know what I have been able to understand? Huh. If Owen is here, why don't we kick Brian off and call this episode 100 and be done with it?
Because Brian,
if you guys want to re-record the whole thing, go ahead. Fill your boots.
His laptop's dead. Way to go, Rooner.
I'm pretty sure that this is my fault. Yes, I agree.
Well, let's see. Considering the topic, I think that you were an excellent replacement for me. It was, I don't know the first thing about
it. It was really nice having you on, Brian, because...
I still don't.
Sorry, Trev. If maybe when you listen to it, as opposed to play on Facebook and buy new guns online, when you listen to it, maybe something will sink in. Because I think we explained it clearly enough.
If you say so. Can we end this thing now?
Oh, I've ended this a while ago.
Oh, just this. All right. Good night, guys.